It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
So in this hardcore history addendum, we're going to have a friend of mine on the program, and it's going to be kind of a cross cast between his show and mine. And I hope you'll pardon me. I have a cold right now, so things are a little less than perfect. His name is Daniele Bolelli, by the way, and you may know him because he's a famous history podcaster. He does History on Fire. He has another podcast called The Drunken Taoist, and we've been friends for a long time, and he's wonderful, that wonderful lyrical voice of his and the way he looks at the past. And we had been talking about doing a program together for a while, and the stars just kind of aligned. This was recorded a couple of weeks ago, actually, which is good because, like I said, I have a cold now. But Daniele came on. He had a couple of things he wanted to talk about, and so that's sort of the gist for how the show kind of went in the direction it did. I'll have a few thoughts afterwards because, you know, as it always seems to happen, right, I thought of a good point or two or something I should have brought up during the discussion and didn't. So we'll call that a footnote to the show you're about to hear, the crosscast between yours truly and my friend, the great Daniele Bolelli.
Okay, Dan, let's get playing. One topic that I found fascinating as of late, I'm seeing a lot on social media, some efforts to kind of redefine terms. This is mostly happening in US. I don't know if this is a discussion that's really happening in other parts of the world, but in US, I'm seeing a lot of discussion regarding the political spectrum, what's left-wing, what's right-wing, where phenomena like fascism and Nazism fit into the spectrum. And, you know, personally, I find the whole left-wing, right-wing discussion almost intellectually lazy, because to me, it's like, I'm not even interested in if it's an idea that comes from the left wing or a right wing. To me, an idea is either a good idea or a bad idea. Who cares where it comes from? So even thinking in those terms, to me, encourages factionalism. However, having said that, if we insist on using these terms like left wing, right wing, then we should probably use them correctly. And what I'm seeing these days is a major attempt to change the way the terms have been used historically. Kind of reminds me of The Princess Bride, you know, when they say, you keep using this word, I don't think it means what you think it means. That's sort of the feeling I'm getting in this discussion. So I would love to get your take on, and you know, we can jump into a whole discussion on this thing regarding the political spectrum, where, how it's changing, the meaning of it, what it used to mean historically, and all of that.
Well, I think a little background probably makes sense before we get started, because
sure.
I think we should acknowledge one thing right off the top, and that's that the idea of the political spectrum is a human-created thing. And not just a human-created thing, but something that sort of developed organically in revolutionary-era France that was then sort of morphed into something that was used ever since. And ever since, people have been trying to figure out how you make it better, because it's such an imperfect way to describe political positions. So as you and I both know, but let's review, in pre-revolutionary and early revolutionary France, you have an assembly where all the people meet, and from the speaker's platform on the assembly, the people who were the honored aristocratic movers and shakers, blue bloods in that society, sat on the right side of the assembly. And the bourgeois, we would today call the middle class or upper middle class, the businessmen, all the merchants, they sat on the left. And then that became, you know, the beginnings of where people would say, you know, a man on the left or a man of the right. And so that's where that initially comes from. And then that became sort of the shorthand that was transposed onto later political systems forever afterwards, whether or not it was a really good description of other societies, other countries, political systems in places far removed from revolutionary France. So that's how it starts. And then from there on, what we have here is a human-created system that is designed to try to provide a shorthand, if you will, for people's political persuasions. And ever since, people have realized how inadequate it is to describe, you know, something as complex as people's political beliefs. And that's why ever since there have been attempts to three-dimensionalize it or create another axis to measure other things that the left-right political spectrum doesn't measure. And so in that case, what we have here now is a spectrum which doesn't resemble the one that you and I grew up with. I'm 53. You're younger than I am. But both of us grew up in an era where the original traditional, let's call it traditional for lack of a better word, political spectrum was in force. And in that spectrum, just so that we have a benchmark from where we can have this conversation from, speaking as an American, you grew up in a different environment. But in the United States, we were taught, when I was a kid, that the United States and other Western democracies fell somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, and that both ends of the spectrum, either the far left or the far right, represented extremist philosophies. Different kinds of extremist philosophies, but extremist philosophies. And so that's where it started. So the far left, when we were growing up, was always communism. The far right was always fascism. And so that's why you and I are confused when we hear people today speak about, for example, the Nazis being on the left side of the spectrum, because on the traditional yeah. one, it was always the right side of the spectrum.
Right.
Now, I should point out that I had a political science professor in the 1980s in college, and this was the first time I ever heard anybody say this, who said that really maybe we should think of that linear political spectrum as more of a circle, and that the two halves, the two extremes, actually have many things in common. So maybe they touch on the other end. But so when we have this discussion, let's remember that this is the spectrum you and I were operating from, and that most people from our era and before understood.
Yeah.
So now let's go from there. So why don't you start by explaining what you're seeing out there that is so discomforting?
Well, start like to throw a wrench into that political spectrum, which, by the way, it's exactly correct, right? That's exactly how we grew up. That's how it was always defined. But take something like anarchism. Anarchism traditionally was considered an extreme left position. And here you have, you know, communism and fascism, or communism and Nazism, being one considered extreme right and one extreme left, but they are both share the fact that they are totalitarian systems. Anarchism, on the other hand, by going radically against the very idea of the state, seems to be at the opposite end of totalitarianism, and yet it was never defined in any way, shape, or form as a right-wing concept. It was considered ultra-extreme left. So what I find weird in this is plugging certain movements that, you know, they have defined themselves as conservative right wing, their opponents define them as conservative right wing, everyone involved was very clear about who they were and what was up, and now kind of trying to completely change the meaning of what used to be something that was pretty much understood by everybody. I mean, to me, it's like, it's funny, because growing up in Italy, I've been very familiar with lots of people who are fascists. I've been in conversation with people who are neo-Nazis. So to me, this is not even like a theoretical debate. These are actual flesh and blood people who I've spoken to. And if you tell these people that they are left-wing, you don't want to see the consequences, because they hate anything to do with the term left-wing already make them go berserk, and they hate that. So the fact that today in the US I'm seeing this redefining of the spectrum that basically places all of the totalitarian movements, from communists, which everybody argue they are left-wings, there's no disagreement there, but from fascists and Nazis, who are traditionally considered right-wing, suddenly plugging them all as left-wing phenomenon, I find that really bizarre. Like, to me, it seemed like a postmodernist attempt to redefine, to rewrite the dictionary.
Well, now let me interrupt you, because that's exactly what it is. And here's the thing. The people who did this redefining were very open about it. This wasn't a secret. The problem is that many of the people who quote them or who ascribe to the same theory don't realize that it's a redefinition. So, for example, I said in our little introduction that there have been many attempts since we were kids to try to figure out a better way to define people's political positions other than this very limiting linear way. Well, there's one of the examples out there that was done is a person who decided to make the question of freedom the defining force. So, right, so the political spectrum kind of plugs in X and Y what you want, and it can end up showing what you want depending on the parameters you choose. So if you decide that freedom is going to be the basis for what moves the needle on your spectrum, well then yes, one direction might go in the direction of more free and another direction in less free, in which case all the totalitarian systems, regardless of their economic viewpoints or whatever, belong on one end. And as you said, anarchism probably belongs on the other far extreme. I don't have any problem with people redefining the political spectrum as long as they understand that that's what they've done.
Well, and also not using the wrong terminology, because if we're using freedom, I completely agree. You can put anarchism on one extreme, you can put totalitarian ideologies at the other extreme. But there's nothing left or right about this. This is just a new way of looking at things, so we shouldn't probably use the terms left-wing, right-wing, which traditionally had a completely different meaning, and plug them into a spectrum that just is something else entirely.
Well, and let's understand, too, a little bit about what the differences of this always were.
Sure.
So, for example, when you go back to the original French version, I mean, those people that were sitting on the right side of the assembly, those are monarchists, right? So the extremes in the original system we're talking about here are people that support the church, the aristocracy, the monarchy, and the status quo. The people on the left side, until you got, you know, the Jacobins and all that, were actually the equality, liberty, laissez-faire capitalism, maybe, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but by the standards of the time. And those things change with the times. I mean, certainly if we were going to talk about what left-wing and right-wing were in the 1930s, it's going to be very different than what they were in the 1790s. But I mean, from that basis, there are fundamental differences between, you know, the views of the. I mean, let me give you an example.
Sure.
So when you look at the Nazis, one of the things that catches people up in the United States is the name, the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Right.
Right.
So for everyone out there who doesn't know it, if we asked what kind of a government the North Korean government of today was, it's a hereditary dictatorship, isn't it? That's what it is, right? This is the guy in charge. There is the third generation, father, son, grandfather of a dictatorial regime that brooks no opposition and has no legislative body with any power at all. Yet the official name of that country is the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. That is marketing.
Yeah.
Right? That is marketing. That is exactly what the National Socialist, you know, the German Workers' Party is. I mean, to Hitler and his people, the Nazi Party of that early era, workers was the same as voters. And this was a political marketing attempt to try to swing voters. And by the way, the centrist party of Germany in that time period had workers in their name. So this is not an unusual thing. And so but Americans get so hyped up when they see the word socialist or workers that they automatically assume, okay, what we have here are Bolsheviks, which is nothing of the sort. As a matter of fact, I can't think of anyone more opposed to Bolsheviks than Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler blamed them, you know, built his whole platform in absolute opposition to communism. He blamed socialists for contributing to Germany losing World War I. He, you know, all, if you look at when he took power, he got rid of the more left-leaning element who were sympathizing with the Nazi movement, squashed them all with the Night of the Long Knives. Some of the first people he sent to labor camps were socialists. So, I mean, it seemed like there's enough evidence there that the little market employing the name should be pretty obvious to everybody.
Well, and for those of you, there are German scholars out there who realize, I mean, it's known as Strasserism. Otto Strasser was part of the very early Nazi Party's, let's just call it the philosophical wing, for lack of a better word. And he would have been more what Americans think of when they accuse the Nazis of being a socialist movement. But he was purged early on. I mean, so that side of it, I mean, Hitler took over, we would call it today, a corporate shell. He went in, saw a group of people who already were meeting. I think there were like 20 of them, he said, in Mein Kampf. And he went in there and stole their movement and got rid of the things he didn't like. But the name stuck. You know, I have Mein Kampf sitting here in front of me. And, you know, I read it for our little conversation here for like the 15th time. I always feel like people that call the Nazis left wing have never read this book, because Hitler actually slams the left by name, the left, over and over and over again. He says they chose red for the Nazi flag colors just to piss off the Bolsheviks
right.
and communists. Right? Yeah. I mean, we're stealing their stuff and we're rubbing it in their faces.
Yeah, it's like it literally, if you open Mein Kampf and read five pages, it would all be clear, right? It wouldn't even be an issue. So I find like some of these, part of the reason why it bugs me a little is because I feel that it is a disingenuous attempt, like that some of the people who have been pushing this notion are doing so not because they actually believe it, but because it's a slander to call somebody a Nazi or a fascist in the modern political climate. So the idea becomes, let's paint those guys as the Nazis and fascists, because then, you know, we score a point over them more because they actually believe it. Because if you actually believe it, now you got a serious problem with reading comprehension, because it really doesn't take much to see the difference, you know. It's like...
Well, you see, you jumped in front of where I was going to set that whole cui bono thing up here. Like, because the more interesting question isn't, were the Nazis left-wing or right-wing? It's, why does anybody care?
Right.
Right? I mean, what's the practical... we have arguments over this today, and you go, why? I mean, this is a 75-year-old issue. The only reason it matters is how it applies to the modern political situation. So there's a reason that tarring one side or the other with this label is important. Now, to get back to our political spectrum when we were a kid in the United States, again, I can't speak for Italy, because when I went to Italy as a kid, they had a red flag with a hammer and sickle on some of the buildings in Rome. So,
oh, yeah, there was like 30% of the country was communist or something.
Exactly. A little different than what I grew up with. But in this country, the reason that we were taught that the two extremes of the political system were bad was because, you know, this was to teach us. For example, let me back up. In 1964, Barry Goldwater, a senator from Arizona, ran for president against Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Goldwater is often labeled as the father of the modern conservative movement. So where you get away from the country club Republicans and you get down to the Ronald Reagan kind of Republicans, a very different sort of breed.
Yeah.
Those guys, Goldwater had famously said that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Mm-hmm.
He's the kind of guy that would have approved of a political spectrum where liberty was what moved the needle one way or the other. In a case like Goldwater, the idea that we can look at different movements in the United States as extreme, it was a warning, right? Don't go too far to the left, because if you do, you take the left-leaning ideas that form something like liberalism and you take them to the extreme and you get to a dangerous territory like communism. And if you take the right-wing views, which, you know, would be a conservative political viewpoint in America, and you take them to extremes, you end up with fascism. Well, in the modern era, I mean, I remember Jonah Goldberg wrote a book called Liberal Fascism, and he along with others, try to trace a development that links liberalism to Nazism as a way to warn you about the dangers of liberalism, right? These people are on the road to Nazism because Nazism is the worst thing we can think of. It's also a way, you know, to say that, you know, if you move farther and farther to the right, there's no bad thing on the edge of that, right? In the old days, you would say, hey, don't go too far to the right or it's bad for everybody. Well, if you redefine the political spectrum so that the right has no connection to nasty political outcomes, well then, hey, just moving farther to the right's always good, right? So there is, you know, I used to say to right-wingers, if we go farther to the right, what happens that's bad? Does it ever reach a point that's negative? And I think that's the cui bono part, that there are people trying to redefine the idea that going to the extremes, to the right side of the political spectrum, have any bad outcome at all. That, to me, is the problem. So when Goldwater said extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, this is the attitude that if you go to the extreme right, there's nothing bad about that because we're going to get more free.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. And I think that's exactly the issue with framing it as a left-right thing as opposed to totalitarianism versus freedom. I understand totalitarianism versus individual rights. That makes perfect sense to me. But don't plug it into a political model that doesn't reflect that at all, because traditionally there have been extremely totalitarian left-wing movement and extremely totalitarian right-wing movement. What makes them left-wing and right-wing is not how powerful the state is, because again, both sides did it. It's other issues, like for example, in the case of the Nazis, a few of the things that clearly would mark them more on the right-wing side of things and why people who were more conservative supported them. You had the desire to crush labor unions was a key thing that helped them be popular with some of the industrialists in Germany. The desire to go against minimum wage, also big in terms of culture wars. You know, there was a whole wave of gay rights, feminism, more open sexuality that was sweeping in Germany, and that Nazism was strongly preaching against. So taking a more conservative attitude in terms of even issues that would be recognized today as part of the culture wars. So, you know, to me, those are the things that's what makes somebody in that case. And also, one thing that I forgot, and that's probably the most important one of all, is that the base of the whole Nazi movement was built on nationalism and race. Whereas traditionally the other extreme, you know, the communists were all about the more international global perspective.
And class.
Exactly. You know, the one was about class. The other one was not. The other one, the focus was on race and nation. One was hierarchical. One was, at least theoretically, of course, not in reality, but at least theoretically in favor of equality. One was heavily in bed with the traditional religious institutions. The other one was atheist or pushing a more liberation theology if they ever flirted with religious ideas. So, I mean, when you look at it in those terms, they couldn't be more different, despite the fact that they were both totalitarians who wanted a strong state.
Well, look at the company they keep. That's always what, domestically, as you pointed out, I mean, the Nazis were taking donations from big business. I mean, the whole idea behind socialism is that the people own the means of production. Well, I mean, my goodness, the Germans of the 1940s had companies like Krupp and Messerschmitt and Porsche and Henschel and I mean, you know, IG Farben. I mean, and those guys didn't go away. That's not at all like what you would see in a communist country. And look at the allies that the Germans had. I mean, you mentioned the Italians, but let's look at the Japanese. I mean, you could never spin the Japanese as a left-wing regime
right.
Under any system. I mean, that's a divine emperor system, right? And, you know, I mean, for these people that say that dictatorships and that kind of lack of freedom is left-wing, well, what was the czar of Russia before the communists took over?
Right.
I mean, that is the ultimate right-wing regime by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, that's right-wing by the French Assembly definition of right-wing, right? Those are authoritarian monarchists. The Japanese are not going to ally with a left-wing regime. Look at Francisco Franco. Look at all of the people that fall into the fascist orbit, even, you know, Juan Perón in places like Argentina later. None of these people fit the socialist model, even if the name National Socialist seems to imply that that's what they are.
Absolutely. And I think that's what I find upsetting. Also, I think for me, there's a little bit of a personal element because, you know, when I think about just not long ago, when I think about family history, you know, my grandmother was literally placing bomb to blow up fascists. There's a whole, without even going into the whole family biography, there's enough there where these were things that people felt very strongly about, where it wasn't like some academic philosophical debates about terminology. And it was very real in terms of who your enemies are and who they aren't. And so these effort to muddle the waters, I find it really insulting ultimately, because it's kind of like changing history to suit one's own need in the present.
It's not unusual either. I remember when I was on the radio in the 1990s here in Oregon, there was a group called the Oregon Citizens Alliance, and they were an anti-gay group. I don't even know if they're still around, but one of their members wrote a book called The Pink Swastika.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point was the same thing you're seeing in the modern day world, where people are trying to link Nazism to the current American left as a way to tar and feather them. In this case, this anti-gay group was trying to link Nazism to gay rights as a way to tar and feather them. I mean, the Nazis have become the wonderful, and I use them in my own show this way, because they are the benchmark for evil.
Right.
But I mean, like, for example, I have a quote here from a story that I printed out for this discussion today, and it's from some historians who are talking about the same thing we're talking about. And they were explaining, let me read the post, because they're talking about all these different right-wing writers that have tried to redefine Nazism as a movement of the left, as a way to tar and feather modern people on the left. And they wrote, as a concluding line, this. They wrote, "Herewith we come to the effect, if not the point, of the revisionist exposition. It is not only to transfer the stigma of the Second World War's genocidal violence from the right to the left, so that criticisms of radicalized populism can be dismissed as leftist fascism. It's also to suggest that the war was a crusade against state collectivism of all types, including the welfare state for which many Westerners, in fact, fought. They reason by means of a simplistic, ahistorical syllogism. syllogism. Since socialism is statism slash collectivism, like public health and public transport, and Nazism was statist and collectivist and promoted public health and public transport, social democratic public health and public transport measures must be fascist. In other words, if you have A and we have A, you're all A, right? And that to me is what becomes a sneaky little debating trick, is the best way to put it. Because anybody who's read Mein Kampf and thinks that Hitler would put up with being called leftist hasn't really read the book very carefully.
Absolutely. And I think it really boils down to, I believe that there are people who honestly read these things today and believe it, probably because they haven't really read enough before. But I think a lot of the people who are putting this stuff out are doing so in a very disingenuous manner, not because they believe it, but purely as a political weapon to use in their political fights today. And again, you know, if we want to throw out completely left-wing or right-wing, I'm all for it. Because I agree, I'm interested in policies that increase the degree of individual freedom. I'm interested in policies that help the quality of human life. I don't care where they come from. You know, so if you want to throw that out completely, I have no problems with it. But not redefining existing terms according to what benefits somebody in terms of their own political fights, because that's just dishonest. That's something else entirely.
Well, and you know, it's worth bringing up what I think is a key ingredient in the whole thing that isn't talked about enough. And that's the fact that, you know, much of the comparison between the Nazis and the communist involves Joseph Stalin. He's a bit of a, you know, in other words, instead of Bolshevism, we're getting a little deep into the woods here, but you have Stalinism. There's a decent number of historians that think that Joseph Stalin wasn't really a communist, that he hid behind the communist sort of doctrine, but was, and I'm quoting here, an old-style Oriental despot, in which case that makes him, yes, more like a Hitler or a Mussolini, but you can't call him a communist then, right? He's just an old-style dictator,
right,
with a facade of communism, because communism, for all its faults, was not supposed to be a dictatorship. There was going to be a dictatorship of the proletariat stage, but decisions weren't supposed to be in the hands of one guy who, like Hitler, called every shot. Now, the fact that it actually works out that way in Soviet Union, in Red China, in the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, that's a different, that's an actual interesting point of its own.
Yep.
But that's not what it's supposed to be like. And so those who say that communism and Nazism are very similar, it might be less because Hitler's like a communist and more because Stalin's like a Nazi.
Right. No, in fact, and I think that's where the whole conversation gets interesting, where the examples are. And I think that the one you brought up is a very interesting one in its own, and maybe another time we can explore it, you know, the why an ideology that in theory is preaching this radical equality turns out to be monstrously hierarchical, despite saying, no, we are all equal. When obviously, you know, anybody can see through it. It was crap. It was just something to hide behind. That becomes, in fact, one of the contradictions in that movement that's interesting to explore.
And I love Churchill's line about the equalization of misery.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then it's even that, like, that clearly would not be a good scenario, but even that's not real because it's not really equal. You know, the last guy in the Soviet Union and Stalin are going to have very different lifestyles. You know, they are not in the same boat at all. So, yeah, fascinating. And I guess one thing I want to, I don't know, if you want to add anything to this, or do you mind if I switch slightly in the conversation?
I know, but it's worth pointing out one thing, and you brought it up earlier, and that's this question of equality.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's possible, and whether or not that's actually what the Bolsheviks or the Red Chinese or the Khmer Rouge were actually out to do, that is a key plank in the communist slash socialist worldview, whereas the Nazis did not believe in equality. They specifically believed in the opposite, the Übermensch concept, basically, that there are master people and there are subject people. What's more, communism and socialism have this, you know, you remember the phrase, right? Workers of the world unite.
Right.
Everybody who wasn't of the ruling class around the world was part of the potential convert pool. The Nazis are race-oriented. To them, being part of the convert pool ritual had nothing to do with your ideology. It had to do with your blood. And so, I mean, this is a problem Americans have with terminology. And that's why I use the People's Republic, the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea to start with. You got to get past the National, you know, Socialist Workers' Party name in the Nazi Party. I mean, the National Socialist thing, too many people buy that at face value. If you took that out of the equation and you just looked at the beliefs, this is how you know so many people are just parroting what they hear from, let's call them influencers, rather than doing their own research, because it really doesn't stand up to historical scrutiny. And it's hard to find a lot of historians who'll back you up on the idea of the Nazis as a left-wing group. And as we said, if they're a left-wing group, what the heck are they hanging out with all these right-wing countries?
Yeah, exactly. It's just, yeah, that's why it really makes no sense on every level. And I'm glad to chat with you about it to sort of help clarify, because I'm sure there are a lot of very nice, sweet listeners who have bought into it because they have just heard it enough times. So that's why I think laying down some actual facts, you know, laying down some actual evidence in that regard is very important, because otherwise Oh, go ahead, sir.
Well, I was just going to say, here's what's interesting to me, though, to wrap this conversation up. We started with the cui bono idea that, you know, the who benefits, right? I'd be interested in who's angry that we're pushing this point of view, right? And why are they angry? I mean, to me, it arguing about where the Nazis stood on the political spectrum is 75-year-old news. Having somebody get angry at you today because of where you say the Nazis are in the political spectrum is much more interesting to me. That gets deep into the psyche of not just American politics right now, but let's call it politics in the entire Western world.
Well, and that reminds me, this is actually funny because you got into it as well. I remember a few months ago, I tweeted this image that I found scaringly chilling, where there was this image of these guards at Auschwitz having a picnic and all laughing all happily. And so you see these people and they all seem like sweet, nice, young German people. And then you remember that they are the guards at Auschwitz. So, you know, the ultimate image to display the banality of evil. Now, you would figure that that would be a relatively uncontroversial thing, in the sense that we understand that, yeah, ordinary people do horrible stuff. We understand that, yes, the Nazis did horrible things. Clear enough, right? We're talking about 1945, not... And suddenly there was a whole storm of angry people about, why aren't you showing the communist guards if you show these? Why aren't you... And he was just like, whoa, 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 where does this even come from? And, you know, and it was clearly an effort of... you know, we need to score a point for our team kind of thing, even though if you ask them, nobody would say, no, I'm defending the Nazis. But that's kind of where he was. He was still framed in a left-wing, right-wing fashion. And he's weird because, I mean, I get the feeling that your hiatus from common sense has a bit to do with the modern political situation, where if you say that the sun is out, immediately you're going to have people from all sort of sides yelling at you that, how dare you say that the sun is out? The sun is not out. What are you talking about? And that there's such a degree of factionalism in modern politics that you cannot say even the most obvious thing, the stuff that's like saying 2 and 2 equal 4, you can barely say that without it being perceived as either promoting one camp or another, which automatically means that 50% of the other 50% of the people are going to hate your guts.
Well, let me even take it one step farther in the contradiction. If the people that said that to you really believe the Nazis are a left-wing movement and they're coming at this from a right-wing point of view, why on earth would they care, right? I mean, exactly. Theoretically, you're just making their point for them, right? The Nazis are evil. That's right. Those left-wing Nazis are evil. But those are people who think the Nazis are on the left but get mad when you're not giving equal time to the crimes of the Bolsheviks. That doesn't make sense right there. So if you say, why did Dan give up his current events show temporarily, maybe? It's because how do you even deal with such basic contradictions that the people who are making them don't see? I don't know how to have a conversation with people who don't recognize such a basic contradiction.
And I think that's the problem, that it's hard to even have a public discourse. And I mean, social media doesn't help, because of course you're not sitting in front of somebody where you can pick up body language and other things that are more likely to make you less aggressive. But still, the point being, we hear these... it's very hard to have any kind of conversation when immediately people start yelling at each other and are just looking for a reason to score a point for their team. And it doesn't even apply to politics, almost. It seems to apply, like, any topic seems good enough to start a fight about. And I'm not sure if this is a result of alienation, of people not seeing each other face-to-face, if it's I'm not sure what it is a result of, and I would be curious to hear your opinion, but I definitely see it, and I can see why doing a show like Common Sense may not seem like the happiest prospect in the world for you when anything you're going to say, you're going to get yelled at.
Well, you know, it is interesting to me that in these particular times that we live in, to be someone who tries to see both sides is seen by both sides as somehow validating or enabling evil on the other side, right? If you aren't 100% condemning the other side, you're part of the problem. Well, that's not the world I inhabit, right? We started that program as a way to find things that we had in common so that we could solve common problems that both the right and the left would agree upon. Things like, you know, a need for government corruption reform, stuff like that. I will say, though, let me push back a little on this idea about division or the anger or the lack of ability to have a civil conversation, because at least in the United States, I think we have a long history of that. I don't think there was some golden age where we could have these wonderful, calm discussions about politics. People always would get, I mean, there's a reason that they say there's a few things you shouldn't discuss at dinner: religion, sex, politics.
Right.
I think people have always gotten worked up over that. But if you go back and you look at the kind of arguments, and once again, you know, the average folks in the middle of the country weren't writing long intelligentsia sort of college type treatises on this, but it does seem to my naked eye that the conversations were held, one, on a higher plane, so that you're really discussing issues as opposed to the hyperbole and name calling we do now. I also think, and you know, this is another topic too, I think we miss having a common sense, a common framework of reference. Let's call it truth while understanding that there never was any truth. But to be able to cite sources in an argument used to be really valuable, whether or not we really believe the sources. Nowadays, I mean, the media is in such disarray. The people who you used to rely on to provide at least some window, even if it was a flawed window into reality, are so disorganized, disoriented, their reputations are in tatters, that leaves nothing to a conversation but name calling and whatnot. I mean, what facts would you argue with? You have your facts and I have my facts, and they never come, you know, they never cross over, you know?
Yeah, what was that Rudy Giuliani's line? Truth is not truth. No, what is that? He said something along those lines. That was like the most postmodernist statement I've ever heard. Where it was just, and it's acknowledging the fact that, yes, there basically is no agreement on objective truth, that the death of investigative journalism, because that's what, you know, as many amazing things as internet has also brought the death of investigative journalism, because, you know, nobody has the money to spend to make it happen in an environment where people are reading stuff online and are not buying newspapers anymore and all of that. There is no commonly agreed set of facts. That's why people can, I mean, people have always made up propaganda, but there was a little bit of fact checking going on. Now, I think anything you quote, automatically people are going to say, that's not a good source, screw it, I'm not going to listen to it. That just, no, I have my fingers in my ears, that's just a bad source.
Or at least you could quote somebody who you read, right? You may say, I don't agree with what you're saying because, you know, I was just reading this book by so-and-so and he said, I mean, the discussions don't happen at that level. It's funny because when I was in talk radio, they used to say that you can't ever delve any lower beneath the surface than the very surface issues, because you have to assume your audience is turning over all the time. People are getting in and out of their cars and whatnot. So you always have to keep the conversation at the introductory level because new people are joining it all the time. I almost feel like that's become the way the national conversation and the international conversation has gone now, where nothing gets below the surface level. Because once you get below the surface level, either people are incapable of having a conversation at that level, or, I mean, it's you know, if I come up with facts against somebody and they say, well, you're just a fill in the blank, I mean, already the conversation is over. So there isn't a conversation.
Yeah.
And in a functioning, you know, there used to be a line that in a democracy or a republic, an informed citizenry is what's required. Could you call our citizenry informed? And if you said no, is it their fault? I don't know.
Right. No, I agree. I think it's that's why it's a really messy situation, which is why I see the tremendous appeal, not just in US, but around the world, of really kind of like the strong man, authoritarian type who's going to tell you, I will take care of it all, because people are confused. People are scared. There's so much contradictory information, so much quick change happening at an incredibly fast pace that people feel like the ground underneath them is not as solid as it used to be. And so the appeal of the strong man who's going to fix it all seemed to be very popular pretty much all, I wouldn't say all over the world, but in many, many, many different parts.
I'll tell you what, reading Mein Kampf again, for the first time, you know, probably in 2 years, 3 years, I read it for a show a while back, but I'm reading it and it's funny because obviously the situations between, you know, post-First World War Germany and where we are now is totally different. We're not in a defeat period. We haven't had just, you know, the Great Depression, all these other things. But when you're reading what Hitler is saying, you're going, wow, a lot of this would apply to now in terms of, you know, he's slamming the parliamentarians and he's talking about how they come out to talk to the voters right around election time, promise them everything. I mean, it's the same sort of anger that would play very well in the current society. And I have to say, listen, I don't have a Naziistic bone or really a Bolshevistic bone in my body, but I get it. I mean, I get the frustration when you see government slowly but surely not functioning at all, and certainly not functioning for the common people. But what's funny is how often, I don't know if you want to call it cyclical or whatever, but how you know, the very things that Hitler's saying in Mein Kampf, specifically to appeal, let's remember that that book was not to be this great historical document so we could read it now. It was meant for a political treatise for himself in that era, how well that would play today. You know, I mean, I think people would be scared if I said, go read Mein Kampf to find out where Hitler is on the political spectrum, because I think they would think, don't tell people to do that because they might like it.
Absolutely. I think has been done time and time again, the whole quoting from Mein Kampf, not saying that it's Hitler in front of cheering crowds who go, this is great. And then you tell them, by the way, that was Hitler, and people flip out. You know, it's like there's a reason for it. It's people. As much as it's not a very popular thing to say, people like that stuff.
Oh, let me give you the converse one that upset me so much. I remember I was on the radio in the 1990s, and I was always talking about freedom and liberty and this America that was disappearing. And right around the time I was doing this, I remember I was coming home from work, and I'm listening to the radio, and there was a story, and it was some Democrats who had I'm going from memory here, but they had sort of rewritten the Bill of Rights in modern day English so that it didn't look like the original, and then submitted it. I forgot where this was. I want to say it was the House of Representatives, and a bunch of Republicans came forward and said that it was awful, that it would destroy, you know, in other words, just going, really, we can't have this kind of stuff. And then, of course, they sprung the trap on him and said, oh, it's the Bill of Rights and you would have voted against it. I think there's a little of that too, where you turn around and go, there's a lot of, and this is another reason that I think my current event show has a problem right now, is that it's hard for me to relate to a current generation of Americans that very well might look at the Bill of Rights and say, wait, I don't agree with 1, 4, 7, and, you know, I mean, I feel like a dinosaur politically. And so having discussions with people along the lines that we used to consider to be normal, you know, 20, 30 years ago, elicits responses that surprise me. And not just from, you know, young liberal Americans, but from young conservative Americans, too.
It is one thing, though, that I'm getting a lot when I bring this up with people, is that I always get the feedback of, don't listen to those people. Just go ahead and this applies probably to you more than to me. But, like, many people miss your point of view. Many people miss the presence of a voice that's not ultra, that doesn't push this ultra factionalism all the time. A voice that's actually trying to make sense out of the current scenario, not through particular ideological lenses, you know. And it's a pain because inevitably, if you do that, you will get the hatred from multiple sides. But at the same time, there probably is a need for it, precisely because the times are so ugly in that sense. On the other hand, it's very easy.
This is a secret Daniele Bolelli attempt to try to find the chink in my armor to get me to go do that again. I know what you're up to.
Well,
Daniele.
I mean, no, and you know it well, and we agree. But also, let's look at what I'm doing. It's very easy for me to tell you to do it, right? It's like, Dan, this is a really important thing that somebody should do it. Wink, wink. Why don't you do it? It's like, well, yes, that's great. Except that means you have to deal with all the annoying aspects that would entail. So as much as I'm pushing you in that direction, I also acknowledge that I'm not the best of friend in this because I'm telling you to do something that I'm not doing. So, you know, not...
Well, speaking of that, let me shift this a little bit. Because,
oh, no, I don't like
it
already.
I'm going to shift this because we've spoken of this specific American milieu here, which is where I live, mm-hmm. right? And I don't mean live like geographically. I mean, I am a product of
yeah,
this, right?
Sure.
And it's a very American point of view and a very American attitude. And I realize my blind spots and my blinders. And when I talk about, you know, the National Socialism and people talking about the less, all of these are such American phenomenon. But the United States is, of course, but one part of the planet. Let me ask you: you go home to the old country a lot.
Sure.
How do these trends that we're talking about here in the States? How much is this internationalized? And tell me, what do you think? We'll talk about European youth in general, but let's talk about maybe Mediterranean youth or Italian youth specifically, if you have any connection to them at all. How much of this is apparent? How much do the situations match, and in what ways do you see differences?
I mean, other than the damn discussion about Nazism, fascism, left-wing, right-wing, that kind of thing, and I mean damn in the sense that we have established it's based on no historical evidence whatsoever, that stuff, probably because people have lived through it, is not really up for discussion in Italy. But everything else applies. You know, everything else is the same degree of extreme, brutal, angry factionalism. The same lack of solution from one side that then push people into voting the other side, only to find out that the other side is equally clueless. So then you swing back to... I think these are... I don't want to say universal trends, because what do I know about every country in the world? But if we stick the discussion to at least Italy, yeah, I do see the same dynamics at play.
Okay, can we call this a, you know, that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction? Could we suggest that this is a natural attitude, you know, populism being the response to a government that is deaf, or that is in working for someone else? I mean, another one of the reports came out again, you know, backing up what everybody already knows, which is the people that influence policy, at least in the United States, are people with tons of money, and the people that have almost no say over policy are the great mass of people. How much, you know, I would say that in my mind, populism, whether you want to say populism of the left or the right or wherever, is a natural reaction, perhaps, to a government that is deaf.
Absolutely.
Or unresponsive, or seemingly working for someone else. And I think you could say in the global sense, I mean, look at the reaction to the EU in Europe, and some of the critiques against it sound an awful lot like critiques against Washington, D.C. by Americans here.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem, that, you know, the human mind is very binary. You know, we are used to good and evil, black and white, this or that, not realizing that often the solution is a mix of different impulses. It's not a one extreme or another, which doesn't mean it's in the center either, because the center is also a stuck position. The solution is dynamic, it's constantly changing, and you have to find the right balance in the right situation. Now, that's not the way our minds work. Most people feel, if faction A is doing something that clearly is not working, if the government is not working following this philosophy, then faction B will be the solution. If the powers that be in Washington are screwed up, then some populists to show up will be the solution, or vice versa. And what I see is just a ping-pong game between stupid ideas, where, you know, it's like the opposite of A is supposed to be B, but B, yeah, they talk a different game, but in terms of result, they are equally poor. And rather than realizing, okay, if A doesn't deliver results, if B doesn't deliver results, maybe we could try something else. I just see the ping pong game going back and forth forever. And I'm just like, really, this is the game we're stuck on? This is like, do we really not think that there are maybe more out there than just these two supposedly different alternatives, except that they deliver similarly bad results? That's the part that I find frustrating, that I find is not even about modern US or modern Italy or even the left-right political spectrum. I find that like a virus of the human mind, that we think in these binary opposites that very rarely actually match reality.
Let me propose another idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful punk rock singer, John Lydon. He used to be called Johnny Rotten. He wrote a wonderful book, and the title is wonderful, called Anger is an Energy. and I would propose that, and I'm speaking for the United States here specifically, I would suggest that most Americans in normal times don't care that much about politics. But when it's apparent that life is getting difficult and that the situation appears to be extremely unfair, that the anger rises, and all of a sudden people who are not normally interested in politics are interested because it affects them. So, for example, I've said forever that if the United States can't figure out a way to do better for poor people and lower middle class people, that those people will make the rest of us feel their pain eventually, right? They will only put up with it for a certain period of time. And there's a tipping point. If there get to be too many of those people, no matter how much you want to justify, and I'm just, you know, parroting a line here, right? The United States is this great capitalist system where, you know, if you've got what it takes, you will make it. And if you don't, you won't. That sounds great on paper. But if enough people fall into the we don't make it category, they're going to decide that that system's unsustainable. And they're going to change it, whether or not on paper this is the right philosophical system. That, to me, is where you get populism, where people are just saying the system as constructed is not working. There are people who are doing very well, and then they convert doing very well into influencing the government with their cash, which, you know, even doubles down on the situation and makes it worse. Eventually, you get populist anger on all sides. If those people could ever unite, you'd have a real interesting. I mean, that is a little bit where you wonder if this isn't the shiny object being used by our typical politicians to keep us from uniting against them. Right. Fight against each other and don't notice what's going on behind the curtain. But I think what you may see now globally is if you get enough people that can't feed their kids or can't afford any health care and they're sick, and there's enough of them, they're not going to put up with it. I mean, history shows they're not going to put up with it forever. So I don't know why we should be surprised when they don't. And as everybody knows, you have two choices when they flip out. Either you get into some radical changes or you crack down on them, which leads to a more repressive state, which nobody in this country wants.
Absolutely. And I think you really hit the nail on the head on that one, because as much as I'm not a big believer in conspiracy theories, and I tend to think that those usually are based on very lazy thinking, but you can't help to think that when there are real major issues at play that are ever discussed, where the spotlight is hardly ever shown there, where the real business is happening closed doors, and in the meantime they have you fighting about transgender bathrooms or something that I don't mean to trivialize, but really in terms of the great scheme of things, not quite as big of an issue as, let's say, where we are going today in terms of the sustainability of our relationship with the planet, of sources of energy, of, you know, 10,000 other things that are at the key of whether the human race has a future or not. I can't help but think that there may be an element of distraction at play there that is like, yeah, get them to fight along ideological lines about completely irrelevant topics to the real business, not irrelevant to any single individual life. Of course, it's relevant to some individual life, but I'm talking irrelevant in terms of what the real business is about, what the big decisions got to be made of. And that way we still get to do business as usual behind closed doors while the idiots are fighting each other over something else.
Oh, we are very manipulatable, and this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is how politics works. So, I mean, you can't call that conspiracies when the political systems understood how to do this forever. I mean, a perfect example is I used to interview politicians all the time on the radio, and some of them became good friends of mine, and they were very upfront about how things work. I mean, for example, they would talk about the problem of fundraising when you would get between elections. So when you would get to this dead zone that was quite a distance between, maybe call it an equal distance between two elections, and it was hard to raise funds, they would go and agree, the Republicans and the Democrats, to bring up a bill affecting one of those issues that just gets money pouring into the coffers on both sides, abortion or guns or whatever. This was a bipartisan effort to fan and whip up the base so that they started, you know, so you had something to go back and ask for contributions for. That's not a conspiracy. That's politics.
Exactly.
So I mean, if people get upset with that, I understand the populist anger because, you know, as problems that we all see around us get worse, you become more and more frustrated with the lack of attention to them. Now, this kind of leads into another subject you wanted to talk about. You wanted to talk about, if not these political leaders, who? And I'll let you set that up.
Yeah, I was playing with the Dan Carlin time machine concept. And so if you had to pick one past U.S. president, which of course is crazy because one past U.S. president wouldn't have the knowledge of the modern war that we have. But in a more, you know, let's say you give them a few years to catch up to what's going on today, personality-wise, if there was one past U.S. president that you wouldn't mind seeing in the White House today, is there anybody? If there's anybody, who would that be?
Well, you sort of screwed up my answer, too, because you issued the disclaimer that I was going to throw out initially, which is I don't think you could bring back any 19th century presidents and bring them up to speed with the America of today so that they could operate.
That's because I know you too well and I closed the way out of the question. I was like, I know where he's going to go, so let me close that door
right
away.
It's not a way out. It limits the choices. That's all. It's funny because this is a question that gets to one's own political beliefs because obviously I'm going to pick the president that solves the things that I believe are problems, which may not be what other people believe are problems. I thought about this a little bit. To me, I think I got to bring back somebody who's going to figure out how to give the United States a soft landing from where we are now. And there are going to be people that don't believe we need a soft landing or any kind of landing. But what I mean by that is, if you look, and this is, again, my personal opinion, if you look at where the United States is now, let's call it what it is. It's an empire. Mm-hmm. And it's not just an empire. I always blow people's minds when I point this out. It's the most powerful empire in global history, okay? And it's not even close. So when you say that, you know, Americans are so conditioned to believe that they're not an empire, that simply strikes them incorrectly. It feels wrong. It feels like you're making a political statement by even saying that, mm-hmm. right? Because we're not like Nazi Germany. We're not like the Mongols. No, we're a commercial empire. Think Athens, right? Or something like that, right? Think Carthage. That's what we're like, and we exert a very light touch with client states and friendly states and alliance systems. We have a navy that controls the seas, protects the trade routes, all these kind of things. But that to me is unsustainable, right? Whatever it is, 600-800 bases, whatever it is around the world. I mean, if that's not an empire, I don't know what is. So I always say to people, well, how do you think that's going to turn out long term, mm-hmm. right? In other words, project 100 years from now, where's the American empire? Project 200 years from now. If it's not there 200 years from now, what happened to it, right? My attitude is that this is unsustainable. But I think the people in the United States government and the halls of power and many Americans assume that the conditions we have now, U.S. global dominance, or the word we'd like to use is global leadership, that this is ever-present and unending, that this is the status quo for the rest of history moving forward, which is ridiculous. And as we all understand from, what was it, Foreign Policy 101, the balance of power principles, it naturally, when you have one overriding power, it naturally creates an interest for other global powers to coalesce, to counterbalance it, which leads to either terrible wars eventually some country bankrupting itself trying to keep the status quo. So when you you ask me which president I would bring back, I would bring back somebody who both recognized that and would be in a position to do something about it. And it would take a very special kind of person. So I always go to Eisenhower. Disclaimer. General/President Eisenhower did a lot of things that I think were awful and that got the country into worse situations. For example, he was a fervent user of like the CIA to undermine countries and all these kind of things. But I would suggest that that is part of the era he lived in and certain challenges from that 1950s, war against communism that I would give him a little bit of a pass on. What I would say about Eisenhower, though, and why I would choose him over those 19th century guys is he's a guy who straddled the divide. He was born in one America and he was president of another America, and he remembered what the old America was like, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I always get angry at with when Americans will talk to me about my political beliefs on the empire thing, they will always say to me, well, you're an isolationist. And I will say, I'm not an isolationist. I wanted the American foreign policy that existed from the beginning of the country to about the Second World War. If that's isolationist, I'm sure the Mexicans and the Native Americans and the Canadians and a bunch of other people would go, oh, it doesn't seem very isolationist to me.
Yeah.
But my point is that Eisenhower was born in a Norman Rockwell upbringing and understood that that's the America that if we could get back to that, we should. And when you look at his comments, he understood totally that it was an unsustainable and temporary situation that we were in the post-Second World War world, and he was looking for ways out, right? When can we get out of Europe and let the Europeans resume, their normal operations, and they control their area, and they defend their area? He was looking for landing zones, right? How do we get out of these commitments in a way that's safe, right? He didn't want to leave anybody in the lurch. He realized that, you had to be careful, but that's why he gave that military-industrial complex speech at the end of his presidency, because he realized that this is not sustainable, nor is it healthy long term, but it is profitable for some people. So you have to be careful, because eventually that profitability for some people becomes addictive. And it's funny that so many of the people that decry U.S. social programs don't realize that the number one transfer of wealth that I can think of, especially if you're talking about the discretionary part of the U.S. budget, is from the American taxpayer to a bunch of companies that make military hardware. I mean, that is military Keynesianism right there. So when you ask what president I would get, you need a president that can, one, see the unsustainability. I think Eisenhower pointed that out when it was a lot less bad than it is now, by the way. I also think he understood what America really was because he grew up in it. So in his mind's eye, he would like to, as much as you can, given the realities of the 20th century, get back to that. And he remembers what the road back looked like. Finally, I think the fact that the guy was a general makes a huge difference, because in our country, it is so easy to tar and feather a civilian when they start talking about changing, the global military balance of power and all this, whereas Eisenhower knew all those generals, Air Force guys, and admirals by name. Personally, he played bridge with them, right? He did not fear them. He could go right up to them and say, Bob, this is ridiculous. The country can't afford it, or whatever. And no American person's going to think he's soft on defense. So when you talk about what Dan Carlin thinks the country should have to get back on an even keel, this is my own personal, bias, you're going to take in my mind a guy like Eisenhower is going to be required to do it. Now, did he do a lot of things I don't like? He absolutely did, but I don't have any presidents who are perfect.
Yeah.
Were there 19th century guys I would like? Sure, but they're not going to be able to. If you put them in the White House, even if you tried to bring them up to speed, the country that they're going to be dealing with doesn't even resemble the one that they came from. So to me, it's got to be somebody who at least existed in a time where the country had some semblance of what it's like now in order to adequately, contend with the problem. So I'm picking Eisenhower. Do you have a person you would pick?
Well, I mean, as you said, there are no perfect guys. And in some cases, we are really just looking at very different degrees of imperfection, because some of their downsides are very heavy. But one guy I like, I can't help, both in personality, probably because he's a little mentally deranged, which seems to be one of the characteristics I resonate well with. But I did this three-part series on Theodore Roosevelt. Let's start with the negatives. Roosevelt never saw a war he didn't like. He was ridiculously impulsive, very hawkish in terms of foreign policy, all stuff that I'm not particularly fond of. So what is that I like about the, and just to clarify again, Theodore Roosevelt, very different from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so just as a reminder. But Theodore Roosevelt, one of the things that I dig is two concepts. One, his environmental policies, I thought they were awesome. You know, he's the one guy that I've ever seen who pushed the best environmental policies in terms of a president. And I think that, to me, is something that should be a bipartisan issue, should be something that everybody goes behind, because it doesn't matter where you fit ideologically, if you have poison in your water or in the air you breathe. So somebody who made that a priority is important to me. And also I really like his willingness to challenge the corruption in both parties. You know, he's, to this day, he's the best third party effort ever in modern times. He was very open about going hard against the people in his party as well as people in other parties. You know, there's a quote of his that I really love. That, and granted, you know, quotes are easy to, stuff is easy to say. Every politician can deliver a good speech and then not follow up. But in terms of the way he did follow up on some of these issues, something I like. But there's this quote where he goes, "Political parties exist to secure responsible government and to execute the will of the people. From these great tasks, both of the old parties have turned aside. Instead of instruments to promote the general welfare, they have become the tools of corrupt interests, which use them impartially to serve their selfish purposes. Behind ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day." I don't disagree with a comma in there. You know, it's like everything is dead on. And I found that his actions in terms of cracking down on corruption were particularly needed. So when you put those two together, you know, his environmental policies and his attitude in terms of factionalism slash corruption, those are characteristics that I think are extremely important to this day.
You know, I always was fascinated with the, you know, if you talk about like life lessons, it would have been interesting had Roosevelt gone through, in my opinion. I mean, one of the things I find interesting about the guy is he's a very, for those who don't remember or know, Roosevelt was, I always called him an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah.
I always think about Teddy Roosevelt in terms of how, what kind of a president he would have been more at the end of his life than when he actually was. Because when he was president, in some ways, he reminded me of my grandfather, who I always thought was like Batman, and Teddy Roosevelt always wanted to be like Batman. And when I was a kid, I loved Teddy Roosevelt because he was like a big kid who played with toy soldiers and thought all that would. I mean, yeah, I mean, that to me, that's I liked that as a president. But as I got older, I thought, okay, this is a dangerous guy who thinks war is wonderful and heroic and grand. But here's the thing, you know, he goes through it, and by the way, his experience, as we all know, when he was fighting in the Spanish-American War, in his mind was glorious. Granted, and he had a great time, and it was wonderful. You know, war was a game then. But then you get to the First World War, which he actively wanted to get into, and he loses kids, right? His kids die in the war, and it changed him, you know? I mean, and that is the Roosevelt that happens after that happens might have been, in my mind, a more well-rounded figure than the guy who was actually in the White House. So in that sense, I think in a weird way, and it sounds like disrespectful to say so, but I mean, I feel like the guy grew up in a way that would have made him, like you said, I mean, a president who fights corruption, and he was known as the trust buster. I mean, he would have gone in and taken on some of the big corporations today, which, you know, what I always argue, by the way, this is an aside, but what I always argue to these Americans who want a tiny, tiny, tiny little government is then who's going to protect us against the giant, giant, giant corporations, right? There's a balance there. And Teddy Roosevelt understood that the government needs to be like a fire, which is what an early American writer once said, a president once said, government is like fire, that you know, if you don't have it, you freeze to death. But if it gets out of control, it burns everything around it. But what that means is it needs to be tended at just the right level. Just the right level is one that could protect the people from something like a giant international corporation that runs roughshod over our rights and freedoms, but not so large that it runs roughshod over our rights and freedoms. So, yeah, I get it. It's interesting that both you and I picked Republican presidents, isn't it?
No, it's fine. Well, I mean, even the definition of that's why, you know, Democrat, Republican to me is like, especially when you go far back in time, you know, that's why eventually Roosevelt didn't fit in with anybody. You know, he didn't fit in with the Republican Party, he didn't fit in with the Democratic Party. He was his own thing because he upset them all. You know, he did things that the powers that be didn't like on in any direction. And in some way, ideologically, he would be considered very right-wing, and in some ways, ideologically, he would be considered very left-wing. That's another thing that I dig about him, the fact that he didn't seem to be a slave to an ideology, always going with the playbook of his party, but very much making up his mind as he went, not feeling the need to constantly fit in with what's considered acceptable by his voters, which I think was kind of what made him fun. You didn't know what he was going to argue before he jumped in.
Well, and maybe we can put a wonderful bow tie on the whole conversation here, because you had mentioned that the, you know, to talk about Democrats and Republicans before the modern era is to talk about parties that were so different that the comparisons don't even work anymore. A perfect example of that is when I was looking for Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt speeches for the latest Hardcore History show. I was listening to some of the campaign speeches of that era. So we're talking about the 1940 presidential campaign. So Roosevelt's opponent was a guy named Wendell Willkie, who was a businessman, the Republican, and he's giving speeches. And if you went and looked, and you can find them online, to his speech or his conversation to the camera, I don't think it was an official speech. It was more like a filmed campaign commercial, maybe, by that standards of that era. You can see how much the United States has moved to the right, totally. Because if I played Willkie's speech today and I didn't identify what it was, there is not a person who would hear it who would think that it was anything but a leftist speech. But remember that this is the guy to the right of the guy who's going to crush him in the election. Right. So so to me, that, you know, we talked about Goldwater being the real person who changed the American conservative movement from where it was to where it is, which was a hard move to the right. And then what Reagan did, who supposedly, you know, Goldwater laid the foundation for Reagan, who 14 years later, you know, comes to fruition. Reagan moved the Democratic Party to the right. Both parties are to the right of where they were in 1940, which if you said to somebody who wants to make America great, were we great in 1940, they would probably say, well, greater than we are today. Go look at the campaign speeches from both the Democratic and Republican presidential hopefuls in 1940 and see if you could agree with either one of those if you're on the conservative side of things now.
Yeah, that's one of the funny things about looking at it historically and not just being stuck in the present, that, yeah, you do see these changes and you can't help but smile at it, because, yes, that would be a shock to a lot of people.
Well, and listen, as you know, I'm not saying that this is right or wrong. I'm simply, this is not fake news. I mean, people can go check this out for themselves. You may say, thank goodness the United States and the world has moved to the right politically, or you may say it's a tragedy, but it's fascinating that we have, and that things, I mean, the Republican presidential hopeful in 1940 is talking about expanding social programs that today people on the right side of the ledger want to get rid of totally. So again, you know, when we talk about going back to another America, I don't think people understand what the other America was. And this is why I have such a hard time doing my current events show now, because that was always what I was suggesting, that we need to get back to some of the foundational ideas that when I was a kid, nobody would have argued with. You might have argued over if I said we need to get more liberty because we've been reducing our personal freedom and all that. A lot of people would say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But then when you get down to the specifics, might argue with, oh, I don't mean that, or I don't mean this. But today, when I say things like that, I get pushback from young people on both sides of the political spectrum. In other words, I, as an old-fashioned American, am so out of touch with today's political world because they're not like that. So I have a hard time. I mean, in the old days, you used to be able to base an argument on certain fundamental truths that everyone agreed with. And now no one agrees with those truths. So even something like liberty, that's a bad word in some circles now. And when you use it in the circles that use it and like it, they don't mean it the way I mean it.
So, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that I've always noticed. Like when I argue with some people who are pushing, it's all about freedom, freedom, freedom. Like, I get it. I like freedom. Freedom is a cool thing. So I'm assuming you are in favor of ending the war on drugs, legalizing prostitution and legalizing euthanasia. And they're like, no, 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 that's not what I meant. And I'm like, okay, then probably we should have a dictionary talk first about what you mean when you say things like freedom. Because to me, that's individual rights. You know, you have the right to put whatever you want in your body as long as you're not affecting somebody else. If people want to sell sex, as long as nobody's being forced, they have the right to do so, and they have the right to die as they wish. You know, and I'm not even saying that's a good or a bad thing. I'm just saying if you are going to scream freedom, probably that would be a consistent way to go about it. But often, as you say, what people mean by certain words is not really the same meaning that everybody see. And that's why I think certain words are poison. Like we should, the less we use them, the better, because they are so hopelessly vague that everybody project their own meanings on it. You know, when's the last time you heard a candidate anywhere saying that they are against freedom? That, yeah, we hate freedom and we need to squash freedom. Or when is it that you hear, you know, terms even like left-wing, right-wing, as we started with, are so vague. Terms like socialism, communism, they are all things that are like, you can have a discussion going on for hours with somebody, never realizing that you are not talking about the same thing in the first place because you assign different meanings to those concepts. And I think this is amplified on social media where you don't have the time to go, hey, wait, stop a second. What did you mean by that? And so this discussion go on forever where really there's not even an agreement about what it is they are talking about, except that you're using the same word.
Oh, it's like what we had said when I said that there was that translation of the Bill of Rights into common language and people were against it. There was a famous quote. I forgot who said it, but it was years ago. So it shows you how little in some ways things have changed, where I think it was a political figure. It may not have been, who said the Bill of Rights would not even get out of committee if you tried to pass it today. People today adhere to a bunch of marketing slogans, like when you say the national anthem or the Pledge of Allegiance or any of these things, and all these wonderful words come out and we cherish them and we almost treat them with a sort of a religious devotion, but never delve into what they mean, nor talk about, you know, what when you say something like liberty, what is the practical meaning of that, right? And this is where you get into the devil's in the details question. But if I was in charge of the school curriculum, these are the kind of things we would be asking, right? What do we mean? Are we talking about just political rights, which is in one time period what they were talking about? Because in, you know, 1787, you had a lot of states that felt just fine cracking down on people's morals and didn't think about that as an infringement on their liberty at all. But you go to the 1960s and there was a whole new generation of Americans that were saying, wait a minute, we believe in liberty too, but liberty means my right to do what I want as long as it doesn't hurt someone else. What was it? Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, the right to swing my fist ends where the other man's nose begins. Mm-hmm. Well, what I've said is we live in an era where everybody's noses are growing euphemistically longer, right? And so I mean, yes. if you change what constitutes harm, that's the equivalent of being Pinocchio, and it becomes a time period where now nobody can swing their fist without contacting someone's ever elongated nose, which means that our liberty is all being constrained, because now we hurt people with comments on Twitter,
right?
As opposed to the real infringement on liberty is telling somebody, no, you can't walk on this side of town. That's an infringement on liberty that everybody 50 years ago would have understood. Didn't mean that they were going to let black folks cross over the tracks and go to their side of town, but they would have understood it. In this day and age, we're so easily hurt. And if that becomes the Oliver Wendell Holmes point at which we can restrict people's behavior and liberty, we aren't going to be able to do anything.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing, that everybody, and this is across the political spectrum, everybody seem to love play the victim. The people who scream about how everybody else is playing the victim also often are doing it in a can you believe what they are doing to us kind of way. there's this culture of victimhood that's people, it's almost like you're scoring a point if you are the beaten underdog, and people seem to really thrive on it. Like, it seemed to be a popular concept today.
Let me ask a question, because I don't know the answer, but I wonder about it a lot. I'd be curious on your view.
Sure.
I can't decide if Americans today, and when I say Americans today, I'm talking about the grand whole, but I think when we're talking about technology being the way we figure this out, we're probably skewing young on that, right? Are Americans today just more jerks than they used to be, or are we more able to express ourselves, and so we see that Americans, and I'm saying Americans, but this is a global phenomenon, is this a culture where we're just trolls to each other all the time, or is this because of our ability to express ourselves has become democratized with social media and everything, that we're just seeing how Americans and other people around the world would have been 50 years ago had they had the tools? I mean, had Nazi Germany been on Twitter with Chamberlain's Britain and France of the time period and Imperial Japan? I mean, can we imagine the 1940s world with our social media now? Would we have been any nicer to each other? Or is this, in other words, I guess I'm asking, is this a human phenomenon? Or are we seeing a change in people's attitudes that is a result of the interplay between social media and our political situation?
I think my feel on it is that it's 80% human nature and 20% some social conditions that have changed, partially because of technology, but also just loneliness and alienation. You know, it's very different if you're having discussions, if there's a community that you're part of, if you have discussions face-to-face, if you're used to mediating in that regard, or if you are in your lonely four walls and one roof and you don't need to have that kind of, you don't grow that muscle that allow you to mediate with other people on a regular basis because you don't have to. And so your communication is going to be inevitably much more abrupt and harsh. I think both facts, I would tend to say human nature is human nature. It doesn't change radically. But I do think that online communication and the heavy loneliness that most people feel by not really being part of something larger than often what's going on within their own four walls, that contributes to not developing that ability to have more nuance or mellow conversations with other human beings.
Let me tie in something that may or may not be relevant, but it's interesting because as you say that, I'm thinking about something I was discussing with somebody just the other day. And it has to do with several articles I've been reading about young people not dating as much as they used to, in other words, not going out to clubs to meet each other the way we used to when I was a kid. In other words, if you think of young people as having a constant sort of a temperament throughout most of history, right? We're going to go out, we're going to meet some girls, we're going to go out, you know, I mean, all these things that we used to consider to be just normal human things when we were kids. Fast forward to now where we've introduced a variable, the technology, right? Something that had never been a part of the debate before. And now we're seeing a generation of people, and again, broad generalizations here, but I mean, I've got two kids who are teenagers myself. They don't date as much as we did. They don't have face-to-face conversations. They don't know how to walk up to somebody that makes them nervous and ask them out. I mean, maybe this is something that's a variable that changes an equation that used to be pretty consistent throughout most of human history because we were dealing with human beings and they can be pretty consistent, you know, across a variable spectrum. But you add this social media thing, and I say social media, but it's the whole thing, right? Social media encompassing everything, including texting. I mean, everything. And you have an entire maybe generation, and it's going to be interesting when they're the parents raising the next generation, of people who interact with each other in very different ways. And so maybe, you know, in the same way that I would have thought it would be much easier to ask a girl out on a date just by texting her than having to walk up in front of her and deal with the embarrassment of being shot down in person if that happens, maybe it's easier to call somebody a jerk, or maybe it's easier to say, you know, to pick a fight or call people names when you don't have to do it face to face. Maybe that's a function of the technology.
Absolutely. And I think that is, we're changing the rules of human communication within a couple of decades, and we have no blueprint for how to do it. You know, it's kind of like somebody who gathered the wheel of a car and has never known anybody who drove a car, never drawn a car. They don't have a user manual, and it's just like, go ahead, let's see what happens kind of thing. We are playing a dangerous game. It's a health, in some ways, a beautiful game, because so many amazing things have happened in the last 20 years because of technological innovation. So I'm by no means the back in my days, before this evil technology screwed us all up. That's not what I'm saying at all. But there are clearly some issues that we haven't really figured out how to deal with, that are, as much as they are contributing to creating more opportunities and some amazing stuff, they're also contributing to some serious problems that we have no solution to.
I think that leads into the last thing we were thinking about discussing today, the trends and forces and the ability of an individual to make a difference in an era where it seems like there's so much... how would you describe it, Danielle? I mean, we always used to just call it trends and forces versus individual initiative. But I mean, in this social media thing, I mean, I was just I was reading a review of a book by Shoshana Zuboff. It's called Surveillance Capitalism. And it's just another one in a long line of books that's explaining how we're being diced and categorized, and files are essentially being kept on all of us based on browsing histories and all these kind of things, and how dangerous this is if you think about, you know, what's going to happen down the road with all of this, and yet how passive so many of the younger generation are about this. And passive not so much because maybe they don't see that it might be bad, but passive because they feel powerless. What are you going to do, right? Are you not going to participate in the modern world just because everybody is putting together predictive technologies that will begin to be able to know where you're going to be next week ahead of time? Maybe let's introduce this topic, because it was the last thing we wanted to discuss today, but the question of how much individual initiative can play a role versus the trends and forces that we're all operating in.
And I think that is the problem sometimes with slow-moving catastrophes. You know, you see where it's going, you can tell way ahead that the direction is not a healthy one, and yet there's nothing you can do to steer it, or at least you don't feel like... Think like things like, you know, your series that you did on the fall of the Roman Republic, for example. It's very clear that the trends you analyze don't happen overnight. They don't happen in 1 year or in 10 or in 50. You can see them from like 200 years before this process is beginning. And many people are seeing it along the way. They scream and shout saying we need to do something about it. And clearly nobody's able to course correct for real and avoid where the whole scenario is going. Sometimes, you know, there is something to be said about, you don't want to say, oh, throw up your arms and say we're all powerless, forget it, let's just have fun while we can because it's all going in a bad direction anyway. But at the same time, sometimes you wonder how much as an individual you have an impact on major historical forces. I think, you know, in history, we have examples of both. We have examples of individuals who have managed to make a humongous difference, but we have even more examples of times where you see where things are going without the ability to do something about it. I mean, I mentioned earlier something like environmental issues. The fact that we live on a society that's essentially polluting the very food we eat or the air we breathe. And we all know it. We all understand that that's a problem. Nobody likes it. And yet we're not able to make a switch. Or, you know, if we are able, we're taking very small steps when something is moving faster and more action is needed. That tells you a lot about this sense. And, you know, you can look at basically every major civilization that has collapsed. Usually the warning signs were there long before they did collapse. It didn't happen in one day. And yet, despite the fact that there were probably very smart people living in those places, didn't help being able to fix it. So I'm not sure whether I have a pessimistic or optimistic view of things in this, because I can think of examples where occasional individuals have made a big difference. But I also get your... I kind of see it as the same discussion as you do in Common Sense, where you feel like, is it really worth it? Am I making a difference? Is this, can this really impact things or not?
I look at, you know, for me, I think some of this problem I have a hard time with it because, you know, I've just spent some of this conversation talking about how much I believe in liberty and freedom and people and all these kinds of things. And yet there are certain kinds of problems that don't lend itself, it seems to me. And again, I could be wrong about this. I think we're watching it unfold and I'm trying to learn as we see it also. But I mean, there are certain kinds of issues that it seems like look, instead of democracy, because some of them are republics, some of them are parliamentarians. I mean, people get hung up over words, but we'll call it a voter driven system. Maybe there are some problems that seem to be difficult for a voter driven system to deal with. And usually they are long-term problems. There's only one aspect of the totalitarian systems that I've ever been jealous of, and that is their ability to plan long-term. So the communists used to have in the Soviet Union 5-year plans and 10-year plans. I'm jealous of those because to me, something like that would be unsustainable because we'd elect a different president if we didn't like the plan and we'd change course. But so many of these problems require trade-offs between the now and the later. And people, I mean, for example, if you said to me, listen, Dan, we're going to have to make changes because of the environmental situation that will hurt you and your family now, but will benefit countless generations into the future. That is a hard pill for people to swallow who are trying to keep their heads above water now, right? I always think about Superman. If you go back and you read the Superman origin story, it seems terribly prophetic for now, right? Krypton's going to explode. Superman's dad goes and tells the people on the council, listen, we have to plan for this. It's going to happen. And they laugh at him. And of course, we know what happens, right? There's something to that now where, I mean, look at what happened in France, where the government there tries to implement climate change protocols and disagree with them or agree with the specific plans they chose. Doesn't matter. But the people then rebel because they're the ones who are going to have to pay the tax for that now, you know, people who aren't making enough money to make ends meet now. And so they rebel against that. It, you kind of go, God, I don't want to live in a system where the only way we're going to make the world survive is to overthrow the will of the voters because the will of the voters can't possibly sacrifice now for generations yet unborn. And yet that seems to me to be, you know, a chink in our armor in a democracy or a parliamentary system or a republic. Any thoughts on that? I think that plays into the trends and forces thing, because I think if the trends are bad long term and they require us to all sacrifice, maybe sacrifice for our lives now for, you know, children yet unborn, I think that's really difficult for us to imagine doing. And then you throw in the corruption where there are people who are going, heck, I'm making money now. This isn't, I'm not going to not cut these trees down now. I won't live to benefit from these, the money these trees will make, you know, 100 years from now, 200 years from, and I certainly won't benefit from using them as a carbon sink. I think the system works against us solving those kind of long-term problems. And if the long-term problems are existential, then what does that mean?
Yeah, there was a great line of congressman debating with Theodore Roosevelt back in the day about environmental policies. And the guy said, I kid you not, posterity? What has posterity ever done for me?
Well, and listen, it's more than that, because everybody likes to focus on the climate change question because it's right in our face. And we get into the question of is there or isn't there and blah, blah, blah. To me, once again, that's the shiny object, because there are, even if you want to say that we must do something about that, blah, okay, have that debate elsewhere. But who's against clean water, right? I mean, there's a number of these pollution issues where you're going, really? Can't we agree on let's not pollute the fresh water? But we fight that.
Yeah, that seems pretty basic, exactly. It's like it should be an absolutely
Is that a Republican Democratic? Is clean water a Republican Democratic? That's crazy. But
right,
it's that
exactly.
Same short-term, long-term deal.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's precisely the problem, that, you know, as long as short-term special interests are ruling the conversation, it's very hard to have any kind of long-term discussion about what benefits humanity as a whole, for sure.
Well, and how does it fare into the imperial debate? I mean, there was a wonderful 60 Minutes story a while back that was talking about tanks, you know, armored vehicles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Congress was voting on should we or shouldn't we build more tanks? And the military came to Congress and said, we don't need any more tanks. We have them all sitting on lots. They're all covered up. We have more than we need. And yet they voted for more tanks because the people in the districts of the representatives make a living building stuff for tanks. So in other words, it's the tail wagging the dog there. And we have a system where we're going to continue this imperial sort of thing, for what Eisenhower talked about, right? The military-industrial complex, not just because it benefits the big fat cats in the corporations that make this stuff, but because it benefits the workers themselves who are trying to feed their family and put food on the table.
Absolutely. And I think that's where sometimes the clash of interest is what leads to decisions that seem to make no sense. Well, let me, just for the sake of not bumming everybody out, let me try to throw a lighthearted one on you that we can maybe wrap things up on. The Dan Carlin time machine, forget bringing back U.S. presidents, forget. I know there are places where you would like to be a fly on a wall in terms of historical curiosity. You know, being at the Battle of Cannae would be fascinating in many ways. It would probably not be fun, right? It would not be like a happy occasion. It would be a... What would be a happy one? What would be, you know, if you do have your Dan Carlin time machine, a place where you wouldn't mind hanging out for a while for fun, not for, wow, I wonder what it would be like to see that live, but for, no, I think I could have a good time there for at least a couple of hours.
Oh, you know, I think of silly things. That gets kind of personal where I'm sitting here going, you know, I want to see a boxing match between... You know, Jack Dempsey. I want to see things that were happening before I was born that I'm interested in. So instead of a real giant historical event like, you know, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, I get down to silly little personal things like I want to see this, or there's a movie and you know it, Field of Dreams, right? Where the guy goes back and gets to play baseball with his dad. In a sort of a ghostly sort of sense. And I get personal with that. Like, I'd like to go meet my grandfather when he was 30 years old and pal around with him. I mean, so that's not really like global history. That's personal history.
Of course. So but that's what makes it fun sometimes.
But those are the kind of things that fill up like the top 10 list of things I'd like to go back to. I'd have to get down to number 20, number 30, number 40 on the list before I met these giant political events, unless you're talking about the dark stuff. And then I get, you know, I mean, when you talked about wanting to see the Battle of Kenny or any of those kinds of things, those are because I don't know the answers. So and a lot of people don't know this, but nobody has any idea what ancient warfare was like. And you can't reconstruct it. And there's been a lot of attempts to do so. So, of course, you know, my mind says I want to be suspended in a hot air balloon 150 feet above that battle so I can see exactly what the physics of, you know, ancient combat looked like, right?
Of course.
So those are, and those really aren't about history. They're about answering longstanding questions that I've had. But what about you? Let me return to and turn the question around me. Where would you like to be?
And again, where I would like to be probably for 2 hours, because before modern medicine, the lack of modern medicine kicks in and all of that is a whole different scenario. But I am absolutely fascinated with pre-state societies. So even going way back in the day, like what is life like in a hunting and gathering tribe, like the way we have lived for most of human history 10,000 years ago as the last ice age is giving away and a new world is coming into being. What would that feel like? Now, again, I give myself 2 hours because by then, you know, I feel like between predators eating me and the tribe next door clapping me on the head or things like that may get unpleasant really fast. But that would be one that fascinates me quite a bit.
I was reading some interesting books on some of the studies that were done in the early and mid-20th century by some of these people that were trying to recreate as best they could exactly what you were talking about. So they were going to the last few societies on the planet that still basically functioned as they used to. So New Guinea was one of the places that they used to go to. And there are photographs of these tribes in New Guinea that are fighting each other that the archaeologist, or it's an anthropologist, the anthropologist took photos of and then tried to extrapolate what you learned from watching those tribes to every other pre-industrial state throughout history. I mean, to me, that's the closest you can come to a time machine to try to see what it was that you wanted to see. And, you know, it's a little sad. It's a little like the extinction of an animal species, but it would be a lot harder to do that today if you wanted to. You might have to go invade some of those few islands off the coast of India or whatever where there are still...
So,
although that could be dangerous too.
Yeah, as we have seen, exactly.
See, I have to turn it dark. dark somehow at the end.
I know, man. I was trying to go for the light-hearted one, but...
No, this is proprietary, Daniele. We leave it on the dark side.
I see. Okay, that's the way it goes. Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you. You too, buddy.
My thanks to Daniele for coming on the program. Or did I go on his? Well, probably a little of both. I enjoyed talking with him, as always. I talk with him more than you hear me talk with him, so this was just one of those times where we, you know, let you all listen in. I did have an addendum, as I said, to Hardcore History Addendum. After that discussion, I thought of something I should have brought up when we were talking about the Nazis and the company they keep, and how this should somehow be factored into where you want to place them on any political spectrum. We neglected, me, all by myself, neglected to bring up the groups in Germany after the First World War that were associated with the Nazis. In other words, we had talked about countries that wouldn't have associated themselves with leftists, but what about elements in German society? I mean, how do I forget to bring up the paramilitary groups like the Stahlhelm and the Freikorps, right? These groups that were formed mostly of disgruntled and maybe rootless and lost veterans after the war who signed up to police, you know, Germany's streets and root out and beat up or kill communists. These are people who fought for the emperor. They are people whom there's no leftism attached to them at all. I mean, these are people that wanted a monarch and were fiercely anti-communist and anti-Marxist and think that those people stabbed them in the back. Remember that phrase? And that's how they lost the First World War. The person that will begin to associate himself with the Nazis early on, they will break over competing weird conspiratorial beliefs. But early on is General Ludendorff, Eric Ludendorff. You remember him, right? Guy who commanded the entire German army for a bunch of the war and was basically one half of a military dictatorship that commanded Germany over the last couple of the years of the First World War. This is an ardent anti-leftist. This is a monarchist. I mean, why would Ludendorff be taking pictures with Hitler and associating themselves with the Nazis? And by the way, during Hitler's Great March, you know, to try to take over the government, the one he ended up in jail for, where they got shot at by police and Hermann Göring took a bullet in the groin. One guy supposedly didn't fall to the ground when the rifles went off, and that was Ludendorff marching in the front with everybody. He supposedly walks right up to the police holding the rifles who've just shot down a bunch of people, including his own butler, and Ludendorff just moves the rifle to one side and walks past him. This guy is not going to associate himself with, you know, Marxist-Leninists, revolutionaries. You know, the old line from the French king holds true here. I mean, this guy is the virtual representation of the old state and the old regime. This is everything that the leftists were fighting against. Why on earth would he associate himself with the Nazis? And why would groups like the Freikorps and the Stahlhelm do that if they thought the Nazis were anything like the leftists that they loathed and that they blamed for the stab in the back theory? I mean, it just, as I said, there's a lot of ways to create a political spectrum as something to graft the political beliefs of people. And there's no question that the one I grew up with, the traditional one, is extremely limited. But as we said, if you're going to change this, then we ought to acknowledge that. And there are people that you'll see that will make other people out to be idiots because they don't realize Nazis are on the left. No, that makes the person who says that maybe look like they don't know that the rules have been changed. As I said, there's nothing wrong with that. But you kind of have to say that you changed what, you know, you put in the equation for X or Y when you, you know, slam somebody for getting a different answer than you got, especially if they were using the old math. Stay safe, everyone.